The headlines: Iran begins the clinical trial of its fourth domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine developed by the country's defense ministry. The U.S. administration calls for a quick and thorough investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. And North Korea slams the ongoing military drills in South Korea, warning the U.S. against, quote, causing a stink if it wants peace. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Now, Iran has launched the human and clinical trial of another domestically developed vaccine for the coronavirus. Present at the ceremony was Iran's health minister, Said Namaki. He said the vaccine has been produced using domestic scientific achievements and technologies. Namaki said the new COVID vaccine is called Fakhra and is the fourth one developed by Iran. He noted the animal trial phase for the vaccine has successfully been concluded. The Iranian health minister said his country has been unable to procure medicines and medical equipment from abroad to tackle the coronavirus due to the U.S. sanctions. Namaki also said the national vaccination drive will kick off soon in Iran. The manager of Iran's project to produce Fakhra COVID vaccine earlier joined us and gave us more details about the JAF.
We had to have animal trial and also quality control tests. We became certain about the safety of the vaccine. And then we studied its immunization rate in animals. And then the case was sent to the health ministry. Upon the confirmation by the ministry, we had the first injection today. We are going to start the first clinical phase, and then we have to move on to the second and third phases. If we get the right responses, I think that we can have the mass production phase next summer. We have started the process for mass production already. We have received all the authorizations, and I think that until early summer, we'll be able to utilize this process. We're going to start with 200,000 doses, but based on our planning, we can increase that figure to 1 million doses, and even beyond that, it should be done in a step-by-step process.
Moving on, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says interventions by outside powers are the main cause of instability in West Asia.
I do not intend to offer a long list of deficiencies. We all know them. Yet, we rarely look to the roots and causes. I believe there are three mega roots, namely international interventions, securitization, and prioritization. There can be no question that prolonged and dangerous international interventions in our region are one of the major reasons for existing troubles. Our region has been the subject of geopolitical...
Zarif was speaking at the Tehran Dialogue Forum held virtually. He particularly criticized the U.S. for interfering in West Asia and said its intervention is not only limited to military issues. Zarif referred to U.S. sanctions against the Iranian nation and called the coercive measures an economic war. He also said the U.S. is interfering in the region to serve its interests. The Iranian diplomats said diplomacy has to be taken more seriously to manage differences and resolve issues. Iran says all foreign forces deployed to Syria without the approval of Damascus must immediately leave, particularly U.S. forces that have occupied parts of the Arab country. Iran's ambassador to the U.N., Majid Takhtaravanchi, made the remarks while addressing a U.N. Security Council meeting on Syria. He also condemned recent U.S. airstrikes on a Syrian area near the border with Iraq. Takhtaravanchi said such illegal moves would worsen the situation further in an already volatile region. The Iranian envoy also condemned Israeli aggressions against Syria, urging the international community to force an end to the regime's military adventurism. Takhtaravanchi further stressed that the Syrian crisis can be resolved solely through peaceful means. A U.S.-led coalition has been active in Syria under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists since 2014. Political commentator Mirmi Alahma says the U.S. has deployed its troops to Syria to exploit the country's resources and protect the interests of Israel.
Well, I think we can listen to the words of former President Trump. He was very, very honest in fact. You know, at first he said that they were there for Syrian oil. But the reality is it wasn't so much so that the U.S. can profit from that oil, but to deny the Syrians access to their own oil. As a result, you know, try to starve the Syrians into submission and prevent Syrians from being able to gather momentum and restore more land to sovereignty. That is the purpose that the U.S. is in northeast Syria. They're occupying not only the oil fields, but also the majority of Syria's wheat belt, by which Syrians are able to eat. This is part of the sanctions. That is the short answer, but the long answer, and even Trump said so himself, is that the U.S. is in the Middle East for Israel's sake, and especially it is spending all these resources in Syria in order to appease its Zionist masters, essentially.
Now the war on Syria enters its 11th year on Monday. The conflict has destroyed some of the oldest cities and historic national heritages in the world. It also led to the death of hundreds of thousands of people and scattered two-thirds of the country's population in search of refuge.
It all began in Dara, where people held protests calling for better living conditions. But soon, the rallies were hijacked by armed groups who called on the government to hand over power. The US and its allies began supporting the anti-government forces and fanning the flames of conflict. A year later, clashes spread to every part of the country. In 2013, many Takfiri terrorist groups, including Daesh, were created as a result of the chaos. The terror group named itself a caliphate and took control of large parts of Syria and Iraq and caught the world's attention with its brutality. For the next couple of years, Syrian government forces, backed by Russian air support, focused on defeating Daesh. The Takfiri group has now lost almost all its territory, but is still a major security threat. In the meantime, Damascus had to counter Israel's aerial attacks on its south, deal with a Turkish incursion in the northeastern parts, and tackle US-backed Kurdish forces in the north of the Arab country. That is how a global conflict has been playing out within Syria's borders for the past decade. So far, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and millions displaced. Despite massive financial support for the anti-government forces, Western and some Arab countries failed to topple the Syrian government. Over the past decade, Damascus and foreign-backed militants have held several rounds of talks in a bid to put an end to the conflict. But none of the meetings led to peace in the battle-torn country. A different platform for talks in Kazakhstan, known as the Astana Talks, however, was more productive. In 2017, Russia, Turkey, and Iran signed a deal on the formation of four zones meant to de-escalate the hectic situation in Syria. But the prospect of imminent peace in the Arab nation is still slim, given the continued support for terror groups by some Western and regional states. One thing is clear. The only solution to the crisis in Syria should come from within, where the Syrian people have the right to decide the fate and the future of their country.
Yemeni armed forces have carried out yet another air raid against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's aggression against the country. A spokesman for the Yemeni army says the air force has targeted an airbase in southwestern Saudi Arabia. According to the spokesman, two drones have been used to attack King Khalid Air Base near the Yemeni border. No further details are immediately available about the possible casualties or damages caused by the airstrike. The White House has called for thorough investigations into allegations of sexual misconduct against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
The New York Attorney General is pursuing, of course, an independent investigation against Governor Cuomo, and that is appropriate. And the President believes that's appropriate, as does the Vice President. The investigation needs to be both quick and thorough, consistent with how serious these allegations are.
Jen Psaki said while the probe is underway, the White House's objective is to bring the COVID-19 pandemic under control by working with governors, including Cuomo. The comments come a day after President Joe Biden refused to call on the Democratic New York governor to resign, saying that he was awaiting the outcome of investigations. Cuomo has been accused of sexual harassment and misconduct by at least seven women. The 63-year-old politician is also under fire over revelations that his administration withheld the COVID-19 death toll in New York State's nursing homes. Tens of thousands of Bolivians have hit the streets in major cities to protest the detention of ex-president Jeanine Añez. Protests were held in the capital, La Paz, and several more cities. Añez was arrested on Saturday over the 2019 ouster of then-President Evo Morales. She has been sentenced to 4 months of pre-trial detention over charges of terrorism, sedition, and conspiracy. Añez has rejected the charges. She took over as caretaker president after Morales left Bolivia in November 2019. Morales did so after the army forced him to resign following protests against his re-election. He returned to Bolivia months ago after his party won the elections in October last year. North Korea criticizes the ongoing military drills in South Korea and warns the United States must avoid, quote, causing a stink if it wants peace. The remarks were made by the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and were reported by the state news agency KCNA. Kim Yo-jong's warning come a day before top U.S. officials are due in South Korea in what would be the first visit by the new U.S. administration. The South Korean and American troops have started a joint war game. However, it is not a large-scale maneuver due to the coronavirus risk. On Monday, the White House said that it had reached out to North Korea for a diplomatic push for talks, but got no response.
I can confirm that we have reached out. We obviously have a main series of a number of channels, as we always have had, that we can reach out through. We also are focused on consulting with many former government officials who've been involved in North Korea policy, including from several prior administrations. And we have and will continue to engage with other Japanese and South Korean allies to solicit input, explore fresh approaches. We've listened carefully to their ideas, including through trilateral consultations. Our goal is, of course, diplomacy is always our goal. Our goal is to reduce the risk of escalation, but to date we have not received any response.
Psaki did not explain how the Biden administration tried to contact North Korea, nor did she specify the kind of message delivered. Washington and Pyongyang have not held talks since October 2019. Former President Donald Trump met three times with North Korean leader, but their engagement failed as Washington refused to relieve any sanctions in return for Pyongyang's goodwill measures. Political commentator Max Perry says Biden's approach towards North Korea indicates his administration would likely continue the pressure tactics against Pyongyang.
It seems apparent, and you know, I'm very discouraged by his appointments, and it seems very apparent that Biden is going to most likely return to the pressure tactics on Pyongyang that we saw during the Obama-Biden administration, which, you know, maintained a so-called strategic patience, but without any initiation of dialogue, which, you know, really was what led to North Korea becoming a de facto nuclear state and sparked the crisis that the Trump administration inherited, where in the first year, you know, things escalated to the point where Trump threatened to totally destroy them. When things did turn around, you know, we all saw how all of Trump's diplomatic efforts were undermined by the hawks that he appointed within his own administration. And you know, it just seems like Biden is inheriting the deadlocked the stalemate that the negotiations were at in the latter half of the Trump administration. And
the UN Secretary General has urged the international community to help bring an end to the repression of anti-coup protesters in Myanmar. A UN spokesman said Antonio Guterres is appalled by the escalating violence in Myanmar. That after the crisis hit Southeast Asian nation saw another bloody day on Sunday when nearly 40 people lost their lives for protesting against last month's coup. According to the UN, at least 138 protesters have been killed across the country since February 1st. Some local sources put the death toll at over 180. More than 2,000 people have also been arrested. The military took over an elected government and detained officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, over allegations of voter fraud in the last election. Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, says the UN Security Council must seriously intervene to stop the bloodshed in Myanmar.
And you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Myanmar taking to the streets. There's this huge protest and plus a general strike. So the international community is making some noise, but the problem is that the Myanmar military is, even though there's been an embargo of arms, has been getting access to Israeli technology, American technology, and European technology, which they're using to crack down on the protesters. So that is a big problem. And of course, the United Nations Security Council should take a strong stand. They've imposed sanctions against some of the Myanmar generals, but they need to have a much more forceful stand and maybe even require some sort of intervention. You know, UN can respond to, you know, problems in Venezuela and Iran and Syria and us in a much more forceful way. But here we have a much worse situation in Myanmar, and the international community seems to be unable to come forward with any sort of serious effort to bring about an end to the killing and to the protests and restore democracy in Myanmar.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're with you with another episode in our series. In a few episodes, we're going to make you familiar with Imam Khomeini's behavior during the period in which Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi was the source of emulation. Although Imam Khomeini was a prominent scholar himself, he highly respected Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi, as he wanted to keep the unity and solidarity of scholars and students of seminaries. Stay with us. Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi was one of the great students of Akhund Khorasani. He took the helm of leadership of Qom Seminary just a few years after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi upon the invitation of three famous scholars of Qom: Ayatollah Hujjat, Ayatollah Khansari, and Ayatollah Sadr. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi became the source of emulation after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. He played a significant role in the development of the Qom Seminary, and a number of seminary students increased considerably during his management. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi made great effort in proximity of Islamic sects and sent his representative to Egypt for membership at Dar al-Taghrib in Cairo. The famous Fatwa of Al-Azhar University's Sheikh Shaltut on recognition of Shia school of thought among Sunni sects was the result of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi's endeavors. This great source of emulation sent preachers to different parts of Iran and abroad, set up scientific and religious centers, built mosques and madrasas in Iran and various countries, and ordered the Pahlavi regime's education ministry to add religious teachings in the course in the school curriculum for all school pupils. Grand Ayatollah Burujadi's presence at Qom Seminary played a very important role in the prosperity of this place, and it was Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, who played a key role in bringing Grand Ayatollah Burujadi from his hometown of Burujerd to Qom. Late Ayatollah Said Hassan Badala said on this, "When Ayatollah Burujadi was sick and had to come to Shahrareh, just south of Tehran, to spend his recovery at hospital, Imam Khomeini visited him several times and asked him to come to Qom. The Imam said on this, "With the coming of Grand Ayatollah Burujadi to Qom, the seminary will be saved from the difference among the sources of emulation and their proponents." Imam Khomeini's younger son, late Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Ahmad Khomeini, wrote, "Among the things that the Imam considered vital for scientific life of the seminary after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi was the presence of Ayatollah Burujerdi in Qom. Thus, the Imam tried a lot for his residence in Qom, and when the late Ayatollah Burujerdi had come to Firuzabadi Hospital in Shahrareh, south of Tehran, for surgery, according to my mother, the Imam sometimes wrote 50 to 60 letters to the scholars across the country to ask Mr. Burujerdi to come to Qom. Finally, due to the incessant efforts of scholars, particularly the Imam, the late Ayatollah Burujerdi was satisfied with residing in Qom." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini very much respected Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. For this reason, he used to participate in his classes, although at the time he was an outstanding scholar himself, and his classes were full of students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Vaizzadeh Khorasani said in this regard, "Imam Khomeini, after finishing his own class, would attend a class of great source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, along with his students. This is whilst the Imam had 400 to 500 students in his jurisprudence class." Martyr Ayatollah Fazlullah Mahallati said, "The Imam used to attend a class of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. I think this attending was not because of he needed the class, but rather because of the respect he had for Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi." Ayatollah Ali Panah Ishtihadi recounts an anecdote about Imam Khomeini's great respect and reverence towards Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. Ayatollah Ishtihadi says, "The Imam used to attend the class of Ayatollah Burujerdi and would respect him much more than a student respects his instructor. Sometimes he would accompany Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi right up to his house. Dear friends, in view of the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, besides his great scientific position, had a very firm character that reduced the oppression of the ruling system and strengthened the role of the clergy against tyranny." Ayatollah Mahallati said in this regard, "After the demise of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, we were at the Imam's service for a week in Imamzada Qasim. He said, 'I insisted on Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi coming to Qom was that before his coming, there were three scholars like Ayatollah Khonsari, Ayatollah Hujjat, and Ayatollah Sadr. But there was not an eminent person to be considered as the power for the clergy. Moreover, the comprehensiveness of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi's knowledge didn't exist in others, because he had the spirit that he could rule over these rulers. Once Bakhtiar had come there, and the ulama were sitting there, too. Bakhtiar was sitting on the step whilst laying his legs. Late Ayatollah Burujerdi told him, "Sit politely in the presence of ulama." This spirit was not like among other ulama. And since this spirit was in the late Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, I said to him to exercise his power to form an Islamic government so that we could repress the regime or at least control it." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had decided to bring Grand Ayatollah Burujadi to Qom many years. Late Ayatollah Sultani was quoted as saying, during the period of the leadership of Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, sometimes the Imam would ask me about Grand Ayatollah Burujadi to know what kind of a person he was. I told him he doesn't listen to government officials. He's very much independent. The Imam said happily, bravo, a clergy should be like this. In our next program, we shall continue this discussion. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
The debate.
The war in Syria is now 10 years old. The devastation and destruction that this country has suffered is beyond words. So what about accountability? The U.S., Saudi Arabia, the U.K., France? Well, the list is rather long, but they were not able to defeat this country and bring it to its knees and to go after their aspirations of enforcing a regime change at a minimum. The 10-year anniversary of the war on Syria, the topic of this edition of The Debate.
It all began in Daraa, where people held protests calling for better living conditions. But soon, the rallies were hijacked by armed groups who called on the government to hand over power. The US and its allies began supporting the anti-government forces and fanning the flames of conflict. A year later, clashes spread to every part of the country. In 2013, many Takfiri terrorist groups, including Daesh, were created as a result of the chaos. The terror group named itself a caliphate and took control of large parts of Syria and Iraq and caught the world's attention with its brutality. For the next couple of years, Syrian government forces, backed by Russian air support, focused on defeating Daesh. The Takfiri group has now lost almost all its territory, but is still a major security threat. In the meantime, Damascus had to counter Israel's aerial attacks on its south, deal with a Turkish incursion in the northeastern parts, and tackle US-backed Kurdish forces in the north of the Arab country. That is how a global conflict has been playing out within Syria's borders for the past decade. So far, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and millions displaced. Despite massive financial support for the anti-government forces, Western and some Arab countries failed to topple the Syrian government. Over the past decade, Damascus and foreign-backed militants have held several rounds of talks in a bid to put an end to the conflict. But none of the meetings led to peace in the battle-torn country. A different platform for talks in Kazakhstan, known as the Astana Talks, however, was more productive. In 2017, Russia, Turkey, and Iran signed a deal on the formation of four zones meant to de-escalate the hectic situation in Syria. But the prospect of imminent peace in the Arab nation is still slim, given the continued support for terror groups by some Western and regional states. One thing is clear. The only solution to the crisis in Syria should come from within, where the Syrian people have the right to decide the fate and the future of their country.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, independent researcher and journalist Janice Kortkamp joins us from Leesburg, Virginia. We also have activist and political commentator Laith Maruf, who joins us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both. And Janice Hurtkamp, let me first start with you. To think that this war in Syria is 10 years old and that it has not ended is quite remarkable and sad at the same time. How would you describe this war on its 10-year anniversary?
Well, it has been devastating for the Syrian people and for the region as well, catastrophic, truly. And, you know, it's lasted this long because the intention is for it to last a long time. Clearly, Syria has emerged as the victor in this attempted regime change war against it. And yet, various parties are intent on keeping the conflict going as long as possible. And so we have this horrific wearing down of the Syrian people, not just militarily, like through the U.S. illegal occupation and the SDF mercenary forces, the illegal Turkish occupation, various and sundry terrorist groups that they're still battling around the country, but economically, you know, with the sanctions and the economic siege, really, that's been put around the country, this is prohibiting them from rebuilding their economy and their infrastructure. You know, it's been a war on many fronts, and, you know, it just, there's no end in sight.
Laith Maruf, more than 500,000 people have been killed, according to some records, with millions more who have forced to flee their homes. These numbers could actually be much higher, maybe twice as much. On the other hand, the amount of ammunition poured, or maybe I should say dropped, into this country is also quite remarkable. Which countries are responsible for this war? I mean, how many countries have been involved in this war?
Almost 70 countries were attacking Syria at one point, and that means, you know, all of NATO, many of the Gulf countries, and those who sent their militias there, their Wahhabi contras. That's even more from different, more than 70 countries if you count the origins of these Wahhabi contras that invaded the country from Turkey, from Lebanon, and from Jordan at some point, and Iraq. Unfortunately, the objective of the war from the beginning was to destroy the country. Even if they would have won, those who attacked Syria, they wanted the destruction of all of the country, the destruction of its archaeological heritage, and the ethnic cleansing of the country and changing its demographic to suit their needs of what the empire wanted at that point. So, and to basically change history with erasure of not only the people, but also their history and their archaeological record that shows the origin of humanity, language, and culture and religion, to rewrite it in the image of the imperial needs. So right now, the country is reeling from not only the economic siege, as my colleague just said, but also from the looting of its resources. So the oil, this is a country that has self-sufficiency prior to this war in all agricultural and small industry needs and fuel and such forth. A country that had almost zero international debt, now in ruins.
Janice Kortkamp, when we take a look at the number of countries that have been involved in this war, maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us. One thing that is reminiscent in terms of what has been said on this is what Iran's the advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati, has stated, that this was really a mini world war. So your thoughts on that, and why it was that all these countries involved and all this ammunition and weapons, they were not able to defeat the Syrian army?
Well, Syria is an extraordinary country, and this is something that has been missing from the entirety of mainstream media reporting on the topic. The people there are strong. They're firmly rooted to the land. There was a harmony of the society that was extraordinary. And, you know, the Syrian people are amazingly resilient and strong, and they're aware, you know, the vast majority are aware of why their country has been under attack. And they have stood against this attack, and it has cost them dearly. Every family has suffered, every person has mourned someone dear to them. Many of them can't even afford to buy bread, even tea, anymore. So the as we said before, the effects have been devastating, but the quality of the Syrian culture that has been under attack by every empire, has been coveted, invaded, attacked, often occupied. You know, they've been through this since the dawn of civilization, and it's just been indescribable to watch the strength of these people as they have gone through these 10 years of a horrific nightmare, and still they are surviving. If people in the West had been given any kind of truthful reporting throughout this conflict, they would all be cheering for the Syrian people and Syria as a country, as those of us who have been really tracking it and listening to people in Syria talking about their country, you know, as we all have been.
Well, let's talk about one of the countries involved in this war, and that's Saudi Arabia. Leif Maruf, Saudi Arabia's involvement has been rather large. And first of all, the supply of weapons and ammunition to various terrorist groups within Syria. Where was Saudi Arabia getting all its weapons from, and how many terrorist groups was it supporting? And if you can tell us in what form or fashion was Saudi Arabia, along with maybe its allies, if you can tell us how they were operating within Syria by supporting these terrorist groups?
Yes. So obviously, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey were the main operators and of the Contras in Syria. And they, after the destruction of Libya, basically looted the stockpiles of the Libyan government that was just conquered by NATO, and looted in terms of they bought all the stockpile of Ukraine that fell to, again, NATO control after the Ukrainian colored revolution. And most of Eastern Europe, they bought all the old Soviet machinery, and to the point that there is nothing left of the old Soviet weapons that were all in Eastern Europe. And then some, they actually, you know, started buying weapons from all these Eastern European countries that are now part of NATO. You know, that these factories were working at 24 hours to produce the weaponry. And obviously, the more sophisticated weapons, the guided missiles, the anti-tank missiles, and so forth, those were directly coming from France and the United States and the UK. And in terms of Saudi regime, we have to remember that the biggest component of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, not only in Syria but all around the world, are citizens of from Saudi-occupied Arabia, from the Wahhabi cult. They are the backbone of all of this. And we saw the number of preachers of Wahhabi, you know, death cults were on air 24 hours during the majority of the war on Syria, that from the ground, the preaching for the death of minorities and so forth. So, you know, ultimately, all of this has been defeated. We're in this pause situation where the United States and its allies are just prolonging the eventual, but hoping at the same time that Syria can't withstand this war of attrition right now that we're living, where, you know, constant Israeli attacks every couple of weeks, and our attacks from Turkey and the United States and its Kurdish militias, you know, so this is where we're at, and hopefully looking at the regional configuration of what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in Yemen, that this is going to come to an end very soon.
Well, you have, Janice Korthkamp, a decade of fighting that has broken up the country practically in terms of the devastation that is caused. But let's talk about a little bit the country's democratically elected President Bashar al-Assad. I mean, through all this, he has remained in power. And, of course, we need to mention the military support that it got from Russia and how Iran also helped in its advisory role. But do you think that this war at some point, if not even to this day, became an obsession with regime change, an obsession with removing Bashar al-Assad from power?
Well, you know, I think the focus has been on President Assad, but really the war, of course, is not about him. The war on either side is about the fact that President Assad was holding true to the primary Syrian goals of resisting Israel and Israel's expansion both in Palestine and in neighboring countries, particularly in Lebanon and in Syria's Golan, that they stole, you know, decades ago. So the war was planned from the 1990s by the neocons who came into power under George W. Bush. They've made no secret about this. They were actively working on undermining the Syrian government from the mid-2000s. The sanctions started in 2004. Christiane Amanpour from CNN went to Damascus in 2005 and told President Assad to his face that the U.S. was already picking out a new leader for Syria. This has to do with the U.S. and its allies, you know, intending to remake the Middle East in favor of the Zionist greed and expansionism, as well as U.S. plans for control over the entire region and all of its natural resources. And yet, you know, all the focus has been put on President Assad as a leader. Many people in the West don't even know that Syrian people have complete open access to the internet, for example. They think that they are in some kind of bubble and unaware of the so-called, you know, facts that have been spewed, these false narratives that have been spewed by Western governments and media over the course of these, not just 10 years, but really like 15 years. They are fully aware. And, you know, many of them speak more than one language. They speak English or French. They know exactly what BBC has been pushing down everyone's throats, and CNN and the White House and all of these other outlets. And yet still, as you said, President Bashar is still in power, not just in power, but still able to drive around the country by himself in his own car and his wife as well. And that's indicative of how different reality on the ground in Syria is from virtually every news article and story that's been published or video shown about the conflict to Western audiences.
Yeah, I was very not sure, Lathmer, whether I should ask this question or not on this particular topic, but since our guests there talked about Bashar al-Assad and his wife, I'm gonna ask this. You know, you have this 10-year anniversary taking place with all the different issues involved in this war, and yet you have the UK police who are probing Asma Assad, the wife of the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, for war crimes, and they're saying that they may strip her of her citizenship. I mean, how can they even come out making a statement or query into that when you have, for example, the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair not be investigated and put behind bars for his role in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Of course. I mean, it's the epitome of hypocrisy and white supremacy, if you want to call it as such. And, Tony Blair was responsible, as you rightly pointed, for the war crime, the highest form of war crime, a war of aggression, unauthorized by the Security Council, that led to a million and a half people dead, and plus the killing of the scientist, the British scientist that was that pointed out that there is no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Dr. Kelly. So we, you know, it is the epitome of hypocrisy. Syria and the Syrian people have chosen to stand by the president that they have. They have elected them multiple times. And this is not because there is no, you know, problems in Syria, like, or there wasn't any problems in Syria prior to this global war on the country. Syria is like every other country, has issues to deal with and economies to tinker. But because it's clear that the option presented to the Syrian people, and not only the Syrian people, all the Arab people, the Iranian people, anybody that stands in the way of full domination by America, the choices that we are given is either to resist, stand by our principles, or bow down and become slaves, and allow even the Americans to define what is a Muslim, to define what's an Arab, to define what is our history, and the future of the world. And that in it's why actually the president of Syria represents his people. That's why the government of Syria and its military withstood the global war on Syria, because of those principles. And it's clear that until now, the will of the Syrian people, just like the will of the Yemeni people and the Palestinian people and many others in the world that are standing up, is not broken. The empire has a choice of more war and more death and more defeat to it, or to realize that it's time to pack up and go back home.
Okay, in less than a minute, if you can, Janice Kortkamp, the current U.S. President Joe Biden promised to end the four-hour wars, but then he went and bombed Syria. And the bombing took place as he pushed for an extension of his war powers. But aside from that, how can he claim diplomacy with the fact that he actually bombed Syria, not to mention the fact that you have Israel that has bombed Syria over 50 times in the past year?
Well, of course, President Biden only promised that nothing much would change, and nobody expected anything different given the war cabinet that he's put in place with his appointees. Many of them are Obama leftovers and people that have made a career of destroying these countries and trying to destroy these countries in the Middle East. And, you know, this is the problem that we have, is that America is a gigantic war machine. We are a global empire, and it's not run by one person. It's run by behind-the-scenes people that wield the power and have the wealth, and they're the ones calling the shots. This is why it doesn't change.
Thank you very much for that. Independent researcher and journalist Janice Kortkamp. And thank you, activist and political commentator Leif Maruf. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitak, my entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام والله لدنياكم هذه أهون في عيني من عراق خنزير في يد مجزوم
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, By Allah, this world of yours is more lowly in my view than the leftover bone of a pig in the hand of a leper.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the great lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is that he is the father of many, many Islamic sciences, and that his words and his statements, as attested by Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, as well as Sunni and Shia scholars, has been attested to be statements and words that are greater than what a normal human being could say. Now, as far as being the father of Islamic sciences, of course, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam, again attested by both Shia and Sunni scholars, as well as attested by Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, such as, for example, George Jordak or Professor Madison.